This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Vito Sperduto is co-head of Global Mergers and Acquisitions at RBC Capital Markets in our Interactive Broker Studio, along with the one and only Ed Hammond, deals reporter at Bloomberg News. So nice to have both of you here. Vito, let's just get right to it. What's the M&A environment look like? We had a bunch of deal activity, big deals, late last year. Is that going to continue?
Yeah, look, I think it was an interesting year last year. It was kind of two halves. So the M&A market was completely made by large deals in the first half of 2019. And so if you looked at the U.S. market, it was fully driven where it was up over 50% in the first half because large deals were up that much. The European market, just given the uncertainty and the political climate over there, was actually off over 60% in the first half. And even though they had a massive rally in the second half, they were still down 25% last year. I think a lot of what we're seeing now are the trends that developed in the second half. A lot of the transactions are of a size, kind of 1 to 5 billion, kind of mid-size, more bite-size for corporates, more doable for private equity firms. But conditions are pretty strong right now. We are sitting at financing rates, if you see the markets from a debt financing perspective and the volumes that are occurring there, they're hungry for M&A product. Right now, so many companies are repricing their debt financing, mm-hmm. but there isn't a lot of new M&A product. And so as that comes to market, that's really available. Stock prices are near all-time highs. And then cash on balance sheets and dry powder and private equity funds, again, kind of near all-time
right.
all-time highs for private equity, near all-time highs for corporates. And so you have a lot of really good conditions. I do think it's a first half of this year market. So when you look at the second half, I'm sure it'll extend into it. But if you can get your deal done first half of this year and not have to deal with the political uncertainty, and we're sitting here on a day when, you know, you can't call an election
right.
in such a...
A caucus, excuse me.
And so based
on... Can't even
on,
call a caucus, bro.
Yeah.
It's going to be a new bumper sticker.
Yeah. Imagine a deal was done like that. You're going to sort of partially announce a deal and then I'm going to trickle it out over days and days. It's embarrassing.
Yeah, and it's difficult. I think the problem right now is people look at it and there are a lot of key assets that people want to sell because they weren't able to last year. And so there's a lot of pent-up demand both in terms of buying and selling. And as a result, you know, I think people want to make sure that, I'm not going to risk uncertainty. And if I can get it out sooner, and that's what we're seeing from our clients right now. But there's not a lot of large deal flow versus what we saw last year, where you saw some real blockbusters in that first half of the year.
And so in the immediate term, how much is your phone ringing or your email box filling up with concerns from a CEO who might be thinking about selling around coronavirus?
So... Look, I think that impacts you if you're dealing with business that skews into Asia,
yeah.
China more specifically. So you saw some IPOs get pushed out,
mm-hmm.
and I think some were because of exposure to that market. Some were just because of concerns on volatility. I think, you know, M&A deals don't happen when there's uncertainty. And so you need to be certain about your performance. You need to be certain about the market performance. And so I think the risk is more... You know, it's going to be isolated to certain areas. Now, we've spent a lot of time looking at this, and I would tell you the amount that the Chinese economy accounts for the global economy mm-hmm. is much more significant than if you go back to SARS.
Yes.
Right? So if you go back to 2003, I saw a statistic for luxury goods. A third of all luxury goods today are sold in China.
Yeah, we've talked about the fall off in Hong Kong.
Yeah, 10% was the number back in 2003.
Yeah.
And so if you think about that, if you think about the importance they are just to the global economy, it's going to have an impact, but I do think it's going to be more of a blip. The other thing I was talking to someone this morning about was how soon, I was asked this question by a client, how soon do you think people are going to start mentioning the coronavirus in their earnings reports?
Yes.
Right. Well, I was actually
they
just wondering.
They already are.
Could it be, I mean, you look at LVMH Tiffany, where obviously the China piece is a huge motivation. Could they potentially declare a Mac? I don't think so. But
no,
it's but you know, look,
remind people what a Mac is.
a material adverse change.
Oh, of course.
So, in other words, undo the deal.
Basically, it's where you can get out of jail free card.
You change the terms.
But almost impossible. I think there's only been, in Delaware law, there's only been one that's ever been ruled in favor.
And in general, market conditions like this are excluded from that definition. I think that's difficult. But I do think, if you recall, when Tiffany's had to make comment about their the main store and the impact it was having from being so close to Trump Tower in New York City,
right,
since the streets are shut down, you're going to see things like that impacted. You start hearing about Macau shutting down for 2 weeks. You start hearing about Apple and Starbucks closing stores, right? You're going to feel some impact. Now, I do think we'll know a bit more as this plays out, but it'll impact the companies that are exposed to that market. In general,
speaking of M&A, I just want to bring you a quick headline. Intercontinental Exchange approaches eBay about a takeover. That is just crossing the Bloomberg, according to Dow Jones.
Just got 30 seconds here. What would you say to that?
You know, you're seeing a blend of a lot of these companies. I mean, this we've been talking a big theme this year of convergence.
Yeah.
And so when you take a look at sort of buyers extending their reach into other areas, especially technology related, that's fairly interesting. I haven't spent a lot of time in that space, but that's something I'll be taking a closer look at.
That's a really interesting one. All right, Vito's
eBay shares now up about 5.5% as expected.
We'll keep watching that one. He is the co-head of global M&A over at RBC Capital Markets. Our thanks to him, and of course to Ed Hammond, our M&A man on the scene. Who takes every kind of people? All right, well, this story immediately jumped out to both Carol and myself. It's a topic that we talk about a lot on this show. We talked about it at the Bloomberg 50. It's just something that's very much, as Tom Keene would say, in the zeitgeist. For more diverse corporate boards, move down the org chart. That's the headline on the story by Jeff Green in the latest edition, or the upcoming edition, I guess, of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. Jeff Green, normally based out in Detroit City, he's here with us in New York City. And so is Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week.
How do Detroit people feel about Detroit City? Is that a thing?
You like that? Detroit City? The Rock is understood?
All right.
Come on.
As long as you spell Detroit right, we're good.
Okay. All right, good. So, JG, welcome back to New York. Tell us about this story, because this is the constant refrain. People say, all right, we want a more diverse board, but the candidates just aren't out there. There's nothing I can do about it, bro.
Yeah, well, so I started to kind of looking at it backward. I was looking at the number of first-time executives that were showing up on boards. There's a lot more first-timers now on the S&P 500. It doesn't turn over much, but when it does, they're more likely to be first-timers, and I was trying to figure out why. So I started looking at, well, who has the most people? And Marriott jumped kind of to the top. So I went to them. I said, what's going on here? And they're like, they had no idea that they were in any way, look, you know, would be on this list. And so I talked to Arne Sorensen, and he said, it's not really on purpose. We're not trying to be more diverse. But he said, you know, I was one of the first people allowed to be on an outside board at Marriott. He went on Walmart. Now he's on Microsoft. And he said, I thought it was a great experience. So he made it a requirement that his reports come to their board meetings and kind of see how it works. And then, for those that were interested, he said, why don't you think about going on some outside boards?
Oh, interesting. So this is a low, so non-CEO, but maybe C-suite or kind of...
Yeah, how low?
How low are we going?
It's percolated down to reports to reports to reports at Marriott.
So three levels down?
At least.
Yeah.
I mean, one of those people that would have been in the story, she just left for another company, but it had been a report to a report
to
a report.
Perhaps the program's working
exactly,
too well, because one of the things that comes with these positions is oftentimes a little networking effect, right?
Yeah.
And a higher profile.
And a higher pay. It doesn't hurt if you're trying to keep somebody. You know.
So what are those perks?
Well, I mean, you get access to both for the company that you work for and the company you're going to. There's access and networking. You know, the Home Depot and Adobe are a couple of the boards where people from Marriott are now serving. You know, Home Depot in particular, they talk about how it's a customer service. They have people trying to wait on you on the floor. You have people, you know, waiting on you in the rooms. And there's a lot of potential cross-pollinization, a lot of things. So it makes a business sense. And it's not just Marriott. I mean, almost every big company now is letting their lower level executives serve in some capacity. Usually just one, but I mean, one is really all you need for...
One is more than none,
yeah,
which is what it used to be, right? Especially for lower level.
It's
execs.
A retention tool. You have somebody you might want to be CEO someday. You put them in this position.
Right.
They're basically the boss of a CEO. I'm an EVP, but by day, but you know, eight times a year, I'm the boss of the CEO of a major company, potentially.
It's also like an executive program. Like, to some extent, if you think about it, you're taking your lower-level executives and exposing them to another corporate board and kind of their expertise and what they're working on. And in that way, I mean, there's a payoff for the company as well.
Yeah, and, you know, the sort of the collateral undamage, whatever the good thing that comes out of it is the next layer and the layer below that in most corporations is more diverse.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what is it, 95% of CEOs are white males. It gets better. It's 20% are female, and, you know, the numbers get bigger when you get further down.
Well, and the other point you make this in the story is this idea that when boards are looking for new members, they are often not looking for white dudes. They are looking for people of color and women often. And so that only, it becomes sort of a virtuous sort of situation.
Yeah.
So who else is shining in this regard? You know, if Marriott just happened to stumble into this, like what else is happening out there?
Well, it's not, I mean, a lot of companies are doing it for the other reasons. I mean, I think, remember Cummins, you know, the industrial company, for no reason they could explain, is really good in this. And big companies like Amex and other companies, it's because they have the policy. I mean, I've written about this in the past. I did an article for Business Week a few years ago.
Imagine that.
When I first saw this kind of happening. And it was interesting. Some of the people I wrote about, one of them now runs General Motors. The other woman now runs AutoNation. They've both been featured in these stories about how they're, you know, they decided, I think it was the CEO of General Motors said, I'm going to put some of my lower level executives out there. Yeah. And Mary Barra was one of the people who got a shot. And I interviewed her at the time. She was, you know, two layers from CEO.
So let me ask you this, because this is right in your wheelhouse. We made a lot of this decision by Goldman Sachs recently to say, we're not going to take you public if you don't have at least one diverse member of your board, and a year from now, I believe, or in 2021, it's going to go to two.
Right.
How big a deal is that? I mean, you know this space much better than we do. How big a deal is that?
Well, I don't think Goldman Sachs is going to not do a deal, but I don't think Goldman Sachs has to worry anymore that anybody's going to come to them with a board that isn't going to have a diverse candidate. I mean, I think it's going to be basically, I want Goldman Sachs in my deal. I'm going to start looking, because if you look at most IPOs, and you look at, you go just pull them up on the Bloomberg and look at the screen, the last two people picked for almost every board are women.
But WeWork wasn't that way.
Yeah, they waited till everybody
and that
made a stink.
Great.
But I'm just saying, a high profile, you know, IPO that had a lot of different problems, but they didn't have women on their
10%
board.
10% of the big IPOs every year don't have any women on the board. I mean, it's not my stat, but I quoted a lot. It was, I think it was 2020 Women on Boards went and looked. They look at the top 25 IPO deals every year.
Yeah.
And they don't, you know, invariably
10%.
10%. Yeah.
Wow. And this is the line of the story that jumped out at me. Although women make up half the workforce, they didn't exceed a quarter of S&P 500 directors until just last year. Right.
Yeah.
So total dearth. What I guess I think about with this framing is, like, overall problem is, like, we know diversity on boards is a problem, right? And, like, novel solution that hadn't been talked about until Jeff did this story.
Right.
It was like, well, just open up the funnel a little bit.
Right.
Like, it doesn't have to be top of the food chain. Like, go down the ladder a little
bit. The company's opening up the funnel.
If you want to see diversity, look for chaos. Look for turmoil. We did another story looking at the consumer segment. You know, it's the worst place to be, in theory, as a CEO at the moment. There are more CEOs are being fired at consumer companies than anywhere else. However, it's also, if you're willing to, you know, be a little risky, it's the great place to be a woman right now. I mean,
jump
it's
into the fire.
They have a food chain too. They have a bench.
Yeah.
So you're seeing women just like jump to the fore there.
And when you're on a board, even if you're a lower level executive, you get paid for it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not,
all right.
And it's not too shabby.
Yeah, not for nothing. All right, Jeff Green, what a treat to see
great
you
story.
Here in New York City, managing diversity reporter for Bloomberg. Usually based out in Detroit, Michigan. I said it correctly. Detroit City. Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He is here in New York City.
You can just call it Motor City, bro.
Motor City.
Bro.
Exactly,
bro. Oh, my God. There's a lot of broing going on right now. Just saying.
Yeah, this isn't a good corporate board.
No. Not even close. Well done.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Jason Kelly on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so this story, one of the most read on the Bloomberg today, Goldman Sachs is Adam Korn. He's one of Wall Street's most prominent evangelists for rewiring trading desks. I can't say it, trading desks with cutting edge technology. Anyway, it talks about the commitment really that has been made to technology at Goldman Sachs. And so you do wonder about him stepping down. Sree Natarajan is finance reporter at Bloomberg News. He's in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. He wrote it. Sorry.
Or studio.
I'm spending too much time. Twitter's a little crazy today. All right. I'm going to step back from Twitter and I'm going to focus on Sree.
Glad you're here. We're going to look you in the eye and welcome you to our home.
Thank you.
Tell us about this story. Who this guy is and what he's meant to Goldman and what it means that he's leaving.
Well, the interesting thing is how much the story has changed just in the last few hours since we published the story, because when we were talking about the story initially, it was Adam Korn, one of the most prominent tech evangelists inside Goldman Sachs across Wall Street. But in the last few hours, we've also heard new breaking news that his boss, who's also one of the most senior engineers there, is leaving the firm. And, you know, some people might find it weird. Why are we talking about engineers when we're talking about a big Wall Street bank, investment bank? Why do I care? They're not the real players. We need to talk about the traders and the investment bankers. Turns out that's not the case. The new Goldman, just last week, they did a huge deal with their big debut investor day where they talked about tech transformation being the centerpiece of their trading vision and strategy. So when you have two people who've been integral to that process, who've been at the firm for so many years, who know all the core products, who've been building it, leaving in the midst of all these initiatives, it certainly feels like a really puzzling move, and one wonders if there's more to it.
What do we
and
make of
especially
that, right?
That it's the not timing. Like one guy. There is a trend here. I mean, especially when, as you do in your story, you talk about Marty Chavez, you talk about Alicia Wiesel. Am I saying that right? You know, these are a lot of important people who not only set the strategy, but were executing it and were put forth by Goldman. So what do you make of it?
Let's take a step back. When you think of all the palace intrigue inside Goldman Sachs of the last couple of years, what is it that we've talked about a lot? Ever since David Solomon took over as CEO and the new management was in place, we kept talking about the old guard and people associated with Lloyd Blankfein and the old leaders of the firm leaving and new blood coming in, or people close to the new management taking prominent roles across the firm. However, the moves that we're reporting on this week feel different. These are people who are supposed to be a part of the nucleus of David Solomon's team taking Goldman Sachs forward, the likes of Ezra Nahum, the Adam Korn. These were people who were supposed to be the next generation leaders driving that vision forward. So for them to abruptly leave is definitely a bit of a head scratcher.
So what are you, scratching your head, but what are you hearing from folks about what it means maybe about what's going on inside Goldman Sachs?
Well, one thing is clear. There is no way, in no way, shape or form does it indicate that Goldman's pulling back from its tech strategy, right? That ship has sailed. No one can have any sort of thoughts about going back on that promise. That is the only way forward for them. And we have talked about a procession of tech innovators who have left the firm, but at the same time, Goldman has tried to offset the losses by bringing in tech firepower from the outside. They've got Marco Argenti from Amazon. They got another senior leader from Verizon. So they have been beefing up talent from outside. And I'm sure over time that these outsiders will also bring in people that they work with closely over the years to fill up the ranks inside Goldman Sachs. And, you know, that's what leads you to wonder maybe some of that tension is at play, although we have no indication exactly why they left. All we know is last week, these people were all part of the showcase investor day at Goldman Sachs, and suddenly they're not there
anymore.
Yeah,
that's weird.
Well, and Sree, as you know, and we certainly around this table, I feel like for years, I remember Jamie Dimon holding some event and talking about the amount of money spending on technology and cybersecurity and all these things. And I think we all at that point, you know, started to say, okay, Wall Street's not just about the finance part. It's a big part about technology. So how do you read this? Is this just another sign? Because as you said, they're not cutting back on their commitment to technology. They brought in some big names. Is it just David Solomon continuing to kind of remake this firm in his image or where he sees it going?
The tech transformation, the people he's put in place is certainly part of the stamp he's leaving on the firm. But the problem is, right now, when we're talking about that stamp, it's about a lot of the people who are leaving. And I'm sure he doesn't like that. I'm sure he doesn't want that. But he will continue to pour as much money as possible into upgrading the technological system, because Wall Street has been overhauled over the last 10 to 20 years, and the change is only going to accelerate over the next decade or so. So you can't walk away from that pledge. So he's continuing to do that. But at the same time, the kind of people who've left, that's a lot of
this
native
is a
knowledge.
Bummer, right? Yeah. Especially coming after after their first investor day.
That's a lot of native knowledge leaving the building, because you have to think of it, in some ways, the bank technology is not the same as the technology of a tech company. You have to build very specific products, and these are people who know the core of the system. So in some ways, for them to leave, I mean, you guys got the word right. It is a bummer,
and you could lose, and you can certainly lose some momentum, right? Sure, when you're building out tech processes. Bummer. Right. It's a technical term.
Yeah,
it's bummer.go.
Bummer, bro.
B-U-M-R on the terminal.
Wow, right. Bummer, bro.
Exactly.
Jason
Natarajan, finance reporter for
It's all about the bro
Bloomberg.
Today, apparently. Yeah, there's been you a have lot of no bro. Idea, yeah, Sri. It's been about the bro.
Corporate broverness.
You want a theme for today? It's about the bro.
It's about the bro. All right. Anyway, bros coming and going. Sri Natarajan, thank you so much.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close. Larry Pitkowski is back with us, co-founder at Goodhaven Capital Management, based in Middleburg, New Jersey, back in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio on what, as you know, is a busy, busy Tuesday.
Always seems to be.
It always seems to be. That's very true. What do you make of this market environment? There's, you know, Jason and I kicked off our broadcast saying, man, there's so much uncertainty out there. We're still awaiting news on the Iowa caucuses. We're awaiting, you know, kind of what's the future of Tesla? The stock just keeps taking off and off despite people still questioning some of the fundamentals that are out there. We're worried about the virus. There are a lot of things still up in the air, and yet the market continues to grind higher.
It does. You know, at Goodhaven, we are stock pickers and risk managers, and we're really not macro people. And I'd be in a better mood if the market was down than the market being up.
Well, you're
so
a value
much.
Person, too,
we're
right?
We're value people, and, you know, it's easier to find bargains on weaker periods.
Yeah.
However, the economy seems okay, and, you know, you have very low interest rates. It is harder to find things to do when asset prices of almost everything are dramatically higher, but... You know, you have to deal with the circumstances that are in front of you and try and look for, in a risk-adjusted and risk-averse way, things to do with capital if you find them.
And so where do you go? What are you picking these days?
Well, if you look at a couple of things that I thought were worth talking about, one, as you mentioned, the coronavirus, and, you know, it's, first of all, it's a terrible thing happening from a standpoint of human beings. People have lost their lives. More people probably will. But there seems to potentially be some overreactions in some areas. At Goodhaven, we own some Delta Airlines. The stock has been a little bit weak lately.
Right.
And, you know, they only get 5% of revenues from all of the Asia Pacific region. And it's not a very profitable part of their portfolio. And at 7.5-8 times earnings, you have the best margins in the airline industry. You have the best balance sheet. And that seems like a cheap stock price to us.
So you'd be buying into it at
we
this
would.
Point. Are you adding?
We have added selectively. We've owned it. We've added selectively. We own it, you know, in a reasonable size. And we own some. We also own American Airlines.
What?
But I think that's an industry that has become a much better business and has been weaker lately. And that's where we like to do some fishing.
But they had a good run last year.
It did. It's a very well-run company. Yeah. Although I don't think
Delta
that
we're talking about.
Delta. Yeah, Delta's
I don't think at that kind of
last year.
At 8 times earnings. With really minimal exposure to what's happening, you know, that seems like a cheap price.
And a 2.8% dividend to speak to what Dave was
Wilson,
talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah. Well, and it's in, I'm glad you said that thing about American, because I do wonder in a case like this whether you're sort of looking at an entire sector, in this case being the airlines.
We happen to find this sector in general interesting.
Yeah.
It's become a much better business. You look at the industries consolidated domestically down to 4 main carriers that control 70% of the capacity.
And charging you for everything.
Well, you know.
And getting people to still fly.
But fare is low.
Yeah.
Fares
well,
are low.
Depending on the flight.
Yeah.
Depends which hat you're wearing. When I, you know, when I see the extra fees as a consumer, I remind myself that I'm an owner and I smile and I put my owner hat on.
But just think about
you
it.
You hand
it,
over
but
your credit the, card.
But by the way, on an inflation adjusted basis, airline fares have gone nowhere for decades.
Yeah. All right. So Larry says
I can't help myself.
but I just do feel like it adds up, though, if you're checking bags, if you want to potentially eat something, if you want a blanket, if you want to do anything.
If you want to breathe.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Are you breathing?
Well, think about it. You used to be able to move around on an airline so easily, right? And now it's like, no, you can't sit there because if you want to sit there, we're going to charge you.
I mean, it's brilliant. I do find that the experience has been getting better lately. And of course, Delta happens to have the best scores for
Delta. Delta seems to have figured it out
a little bit better.
I mean, I'm an Atlanta
guy.
Full
disclosure.
I've been flying Delta for a long time. But I will say, as a longtime Delta person, they went through a terrible period. I mean, like, they went through a period where they were the worst.
The industry, I feel like everyone does, doesn't it? A long, difficult period. Yeah. But I think they've come out of it, and I don't think they go back to that. And I don't think the market has given them, you know, their proper due for having become a much better business.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Uncle Warren, Warren Buffett. Berkshire is another name that you like. Tell us why. That's not an obvious pick.
I call it hiding in plain sight. I mean, who would believe after all these decades of notoriety and unbelievable success that Berkshire would be priced at what I consider to be a very attractive level? I mean, it might be, depending on, we don't know what book value was at the end of the year, and let's use that as a rough proxy, but assume the fourth quarter it was up in the high single digits. Berkshire could be priced today at around 1.3 times book value. And it's not, what you have to really appreciate what's beneath the surface. You have a bunch of very strong big businesses that throw off an enormous amount of cash, Burlington Northern, all the insurance companies. You have a big investment portfolio that's $200 billion probably today. You have talented people all through the organization. You have $120 billion of cash, which is enormous optionality in any kind of a downturn. And he has begun repurchasing stock, you know, probably 10 to 15% below the current price. So, it's amazing to me that after all these years, that is available at what I consider to be way below intrinsic value at a very attractive price.
Alphabet, they just reported earnings yesterday, right?
Big, stocks
down 2.6%. Big holding for you guys. Have you added on the selling today, or what's your take here?
To go backwards, you know, we've probably made five times our money in Alphabet. We did not buy any today.
So been paring back, I think?
No. Not very lately. You know, if you, you know, sitting on a high quality holding, if it's growing and you feel the intrinsic value is marching forward, can often turn out to be a wonderful way to compound money. I thought the earnings were fine. I think there's all kinds of volatility. I don't think they spend a lot of time guiding investors ahead of earnings. And so you get some volatility. But, you know, I thought what they articulated as far as future growth, and they did buy back a lot more stock in the quarter than they have previously. I think it was just fine. And of course, what you pay for an investment matters a lot, and we paid a very good price.
We just want to mention a headline crossing. This is about Boeing, said to set its new loan size at $13 billion. So this is all connected with the 737. In terms of the MAX. Boeing, is that something that you'd be picking up?
You know, it's an interesting thing to look at. Well, it does have, the MAX has had an interesting impact on the airline companies, some good and some bad. Good is taking capacity out. And
but
bad,
you're not buying Boeing?
Not at the moment.
All right.
But it is on the pile.
Sale.
It is on the pile.
Just going to say. Right.
Larry Pitkowski, co-founder and portfolio manager over at Goodhaven Capital Management. Always good to catch up with you. Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern only on Bloomberg Radio.